We're facing a matter of life or death. Is it that serious? Hell yeah, it's that serious. When you vote a president into office, you're literally putting your life and the lives of your families in somebody else's hands. Now that's serious. On November 2nd, vote or die.
You know, 50 Cent has more power than a Kerry or Bush in these communities. You know, Ellen DeGeneres, Leonardo DiCaprio. So they wanted to use their power in a positive way. We bigger than Kerry.
Shut the hell up, P. Diddy. All this nonsense about when you vote for a president, you're voting into office someone whose lives you're putting your lives into that person's hands. No, basically, you're voting what slave master you would prefer administering the empire. And then you babble out, November 2nd, vote or die. You mean, in other words, there won't be any police corruption and shooting of innocent black people? Uninsured health care people will become insured, the death penalty is going to stop, environmental racism that causes premature death is going to evaporate, the war in Iraq is going to stop. Look, voting for which slave plantation, old master, that you want, you know, plantation from old master Republican or old master Democrat, is not freedom. It's choosing to be worked to death like a donkey. Or an elephant. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 101.1 / Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and RadioForAll.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to start off with one of Sam's favorite words, war. But we're going to deal with it in the context of a war against women. And then we're going to deal with the Beyond the Shadow segment as it deals with how even little liberal historians like Howard Zinn get zigzagged when it comes to bourgeois politics. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Go to the final question. For the president, it's from Linda Grable.
Mr. President, please give three instances in which you came to realize that you had made the wrong decision.
I've made many decisions. Some tactical, some appointmental. That answer your question?
No, it doesn't. Senator.
I should just say three simple things that he did wrong. He didn't pursue Osama bin Laden. He gave tax cuts to the very rich, and he mistakenly went to war in Iraq. Then I should just sit down, confident in the fact that I just cleaned the president's clock and not say anything else. But I'm not going to do that. No, I'm going to keep on talking. Why? Because I can't help myself.
Of the American way of life, whose links are tied with the battle for control of women in general, like gays, lesbians, and blacks. In other words, who controls the individual and collective lives of females? Females themselves, or the racist, sexist body of those in control of this white male-dominated patriarchal capitalist state system? This same system that has currently and historically paid women less for doing the same job as white males, barred them from certain jobs and voting rights, and denied them, especially black women and women of color, of equal protection under the law. The state is not about to willingly concede control of women's bodies to women themselves. For if you can control women's reproduction rights, you can control them. Nor are those in control of this capitalist system morally moved to concede the human rights of control of women's bodies to women themselves, because basically they have no decent form of morals. And in tradition of America's violent history, those in power and their supporters are willing to use any means to keep women in their place. After losing the battle in the courts and legislation process, anti-abortion fanatics have joined and built forces with racist organizations who, true to their traditions, have used terroristic tactics to try and make it impossible for women, in this case, to obtain a safe abortion. In an ever-widening trend, in a two-year span, at least 15 people were injured. 37 bombings in 33 states have occurred by these terrorists. 123 cases of arson. 1,500 cases of assault, burglary, stalking, and sabotage, 5 murders, 400 death threats in the year 1994 alone, and around $13 million in property damage. Michelle Shannon, an anti-abortion terrorist who was convicted of wounding an abortion clinic doctor in Kansas, owned a manual that was found buried in her backyard explaining in detail on how to make plastic explosives, bomb-setting devices, and the making and dispersing of toxic chemicals through the air duct ventilation system at clinics. The book also instructs its readers on how to avoid leaving fingerprints on guns and urges its readers to cut off the thumbs of abortion-performing doctors. Other books of the same inkling of this extremist fraction of the anti-abortionist movement are also extremely racist, anti-Semitic, and homophobic. Even though there are many in the anti-abortionist movement who give soundbite denunciations of these actions, many of these same people, especially in the Christian right fraction that espouses dominion theology and or Christian reconstructionalism, have made a theoretical, ideological, and tactical block with the racist, economically violent right, Republicans, Democrats, many liberals, and the economically, physically violent right, Nazis, Christian patriots, and certain racial malicious groups. The common links that these groups have had is that they have always seen eye to eye when it comes to suppressing the human rights of gays, lesbians, women, and people of color. And when those of the respectable right lose battles in the courts and legislation process, they drift quite naturally to their physically violent soulmates like the Klan Nazis and Christian patriot types movements. American slavery, one of the most violent forms of dehumanization there's ever been, was endorsed by many of the right wing's American Christian groups of the time and was looked upon as the white man's humble burden. Blacks were subhuman and or at least, if not both, punished by God. Remember the Cain and Abel, descendant of Ham mythology? This was all about the exploitation and control of blacks and Indians primarily, for their land. But after the courageous participation of over 200,000 black soldiers during the Civil War for the North, the South was crushed. This victory, which Lincoln himself had to admit could not have been won without black participation, was over the issue of slavery, i.e. control and exploitation of blacks, and how this would play out in American society. But for the South, including those in the various political and God-based institutions, it meant more than that. As many right-wingers still express today, saying it's over our American way of life. Even though their American way of life meant the bondage and dehumanization of blacks, that wasn't the issue. It was about the control politically that was physically justified through ideology for their economic benefit. Just like today, when the anti-abortionists scream for the return of the traditional American way of life with its traditional American values. What they are saying is that let's send women back further into their restricted freedoms of the good old days, and the control of the reproduction system, rights, and freedoms is a key to that. And those of that persuasion will use any means to sustain that control. The links are clear. The Christian group called the Ku Klux Klan sprang out during the newly freed slave reconstruction period to re-disenfranchise by physical violence black people, to restore the old slaveocracy. In other words, put black people back on the plantation by destroying, with a nod of approval by the Democrats and Republicans, the human rights of blacks, to restore their traditional way of life. Today, concerning women's reproduction rights, the White Patriot Party, formerly the Confederate Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, published a death letter threat to its paper called The Confederate Leader, stating that, quote, Jew abortion king Bernard Nathanson of New York City was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death by hanging by a fair and unbiased judge and jury of the White Patriots on May 19th in Silver City, North Carolina. Nathanson was convicted of 55,000 counts of first-degree murder, treason against the United States of America, and conspiracy to commit genocide against the white race. Unquote. In 1992, religious leader Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue, a Christian Reconstructionist, put out a wanted poster reminiscent of the Klan's on David Gunn, with Gunn's photograph, home address, and telephone number. Gunn was later shot and killed by Michael Griffin, a person who was recruited by ex-Florida Klan member John Burke into the group Rescue America. Quote, "Fundamentalist Christians and those people in the Klan," said Burke, "are pretty close, scary close, fighting for God and country. Someday we may all be in the trenches together in the fight against unborn children," unquote. Just like they fought and still fight for the disenfranchisement of blacks and homosexuals, the links are clear. Paul Hill, author of the book Should We Defend Born and Unborn Children by Force, founded the Anti-Abortion Defense Action Group, which justified the murder of abortion-performing doctors by stating that it was for the purpose of defending the lives of unborn children. A manifesto was signed by more than 30 leaders of the direct action anti-abortionist movement. These movements, groupings, are based off the fact that women are fighting for their human rights, and this resistance, like black resistance, brings out a reactionary response. As John Rustami, the premier ideologist of the Christian Reconstructionist movement, makes extremely, extremely clear. Quote, "How could these churches call racism a sin? Racism is a sin in the humanist religion, not in the true Christian faith based upon the Bible. There was a time in America when interracial marriage was against the law and integration was not only socially but religiously unacceptable. In those days, America had no racial problems, nor killing plagues such as AIDS. The white nomadic race who settled within her borders knew that they were Israel and that the law of God forbids certain racial interactions," unquote. What he's saying in effect is that there were no racial problems before black resistance forced a response by the state and its racists, even though there was black slavery, black suffrage, and black bondage. But to them, and to him, that was no problem. Once the resistance to organized struggle began in a liberating movement towards freedom, that's when the problems began. Just like women in homosexual struggles, there's no problem in their suffrage and exploitation. There is a problem when they resist against it. And these same forces in America, Christians from the right, Klansmen, Nazis, bourgeois capitalist politicians in the Democrat and Republican Party, join forces to disenfranchise these groups. But this is truly about economic class warfare with a little socialization twist thrown in the mix. And the best way to sustain this economic class exploitation for the benefit, financial benefit, of an elite ruling class of capitalists, transnationalists, multinationalist owning groups consisting mainly of white males is to divide the masses of common working class people along race, gender, sexual preferences, and hocus-pocus invisible man belief systems. True democracy is hypocrisy in this system. Democracy, or true justice through human, social, cultural, political, and socio-economic rights, is a threat in this system. Quote, "Supernatural Christianity and democracy are inevitable enemies," states Rustami, "and democracy becomes a heresy," unquote. What he's saying is that those who are exploited in this system, like for instance women concerning their democratic and human rights over their reproduction freedoms, women must see their rights of freedom, i.e. democracy, crushed. Just like blacks and other people of color, gay, lesbians, and the working class masses in general. How else are you going to control and restrict a population from their basic human rights? And when you open your eyes, it's the same barbaric players united against our rights. The links are clear. The question is, when are we going to link up as a class force to do something about this madness? This has been Tracy James with a commentary. The War on Women's Reproduction Freedoms. The links are clear. Out.
to have peace, to keep the world alive and war to cease. We gotta have joy to win our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice. The world knows there's no choice. The faking save the children, the little ones who just don't understand. Give them a chance to breathe their young and help.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Tonight, this segment on Beyond the Shadow is going to deal with Howard Zinn. You know, it becomes clearer every day when one listens to these various liberal, progressive intellectuals / historians or whatever, how completely demoralized they are, and how they deserve the term flip-flop when it comes to their analysis more than a little Kerry does. But it's also an highlight of where the social justice radical movement is in America. You know, the other day, Amy Goodman, host of a show called Democracy Now!, had on Howard Zinn. And they go over various issues. And we're going to take this step by step and mix it with some other stuff to kind of highlight the confusion many of those people like Zinn have found themselves in. We've dealt with some of these other guys in the past, you know, whether it's the Chomsky types or Norm Solomons, who are, you know, anyone but Bush type thing. Now let's deal with it from a historian's perspective. So first, let's take it where Zinn is asked to comment on the current presidential race. So check this out, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
Well, right now, we're going to turn to historian Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, now a new book with Anthony Aronoff called Voices of People's History of the United States. He joins us in our Firefox studio here at Democracy Now! Welcome, Howard Zinn.
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. If you could just comment overall about this presidential contest right now. We are just weeks away from the election.
The contest, unfortunately, is not giving us any kind of fundamental reappraisal of American policy, foreign and domestic. By a fundamental reappraisal, we are dealing with the serious issue of the war in Iraq, and we're dealing with the serious issues of health and education and what to do with the wealth of the United States to help people. And neither candidate is addressing the fundamentals. By that I mean, I heard them on the clip that you showed and talked about Osama bin Laden and exchange, accusations about it, and Bush denying, of course, as he denies everything, about what he said, and saying, I know you said that. It's not important, really, about Osama bin Laden. They're always trying to focus our attention on something that's not fundamental. What's fundamental is not one particular man. What's fundamental is not even Al-Qaeda. What's fundamental, really, is American policy in the world. Because if there's a root of terrorism, and that's the problem, getting at the root of terrorism, the root of terrorism is not any one man, not any group of people in this country or that country. There are too many countries where there's anger against the United States, where that anger against the United States can turn into fanaticism and into terrorism. And the reason is all this anger against the United States is that America has its hands, its armies, its military bases in too many countries in the world. We are intervening too violently in too many places. We are initiating the wars that we have in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have military bases in over 100 countries. We've been supporting the occupation of the Palestinian lands. In other words, Bush and Sharon have been acting in the same superficial way and absolutely unproductive way in dealing with violence. And I think that neither candidate is really dealing with the question of what is the role of America in the world. Are we continuing to be a military superpower, sending our troops everywhere whenever we feel like, or are we going to become a peaceful nation and use our immense resources to help people in this country and do something about universal health care, do something about education, and at the same time have resources available so we can deal with the other problems in the world, the problems even more serious than Iraq, like the enormous disaster in the Sudan and for the AIDS in Africa. If you have a $400 billion military budget, if you're sending troops and keeping troops in other countries in the world, you don't have any resources left to deal with the really serious human disasters that are taking place there and here.
All right, so right off you get how confused Zen is when he starts off quite rightly talking about how neither candidate, in a sense, how neither candidate is dealing with the fundamental questions. Well, when he says that, he's talking from kind of like a little petty bourgeois perspective because in reality, they are dealing with the fundamental questions. They're just dealing with it through the lenses of the imperial class that they serve. That's the reality. Boy George plans to continue on crushing up as much of the third world to expand Sam's grip in those particular regions for global resource hegemony. And so does Kerry. He just thinks that more troops should have been added and stuff like that. So they are dealing with some of the fundamental questions. The fact that 40 million plus people in America don't have any kind of health care coverage, That's not fundamental to them, because it's not fundamental to the ruling class in general. That's who they're serving. That's who they serve. I mean, that's just the real world. But if you have some kind of false illusion and or dream that somehow you can eke out some kind of image or character into Kerry because he's a raggedy Democrat, something out of him that does not exist, then you'll forever be fooling yourself. Now, he then goes into, you know, saying, you know, what is fundamental in American policy is to deal with the roots of terrorism, and that's just not one man, which of course he's right about that. But then he goes into this whole bit about how people need to look into the reasons for the anger, and talks about how Sam has his hands in all these different people's land, over 100 bases in other people's land. He's initiating war. You know, this is all part of being a capitalist empire. You know, it's not one politician is going to instigate any better form of imperialism. You know, what are we talking, this soft imperialism versus hard imperialism nonsense again? You know, where we went into a whole show where basically you had this raggedy Democrats or their liberal type supporters defining Kerry as being someone better because he's a soft imperialist instead of a go-it-alone John Wayne hard imperialist, you know, which in many ways is, you know, more about the state of the world today and how confident those in the U.S. imperialist killing machine feel that they are at this particular time. But to hear Zen go on and on about, are we going to become a peaceful nation? Well, I mean, if you're thinking being a peaceful nation within the context of supporting a Democrat or a Republican, you know, then you're in some kind of illusion. I mean, this is ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that these guys are just administrators for the ruling class, and their job is to serve that particular class, and that's what they basically do. Many of the things about what Zen said people are angry about America about has to do with the pauperization of the planet, how the whole planet has been turned into a giant Indian reservation. And Kerry has been steadfast in his insistence that this projection keep on its manifest destiny. It is Kerry that has backed NAFTA. The Zapatistas, realizing their pauperization on this global Indian reservation camp, as soon as that bill was passed, they went on a revolt. Kerry is back GATT. Kerry's a backer of WTO. Kerry's a backer of the World Bank IMF policy, which places in structural adjustment, which is a way of structurally adjusting people into a cemented concrete form of indebted poverty, malnourishment, degradation, disease, you know, dying over a clean cup of water. These are all policies that Kerry backs. Kerry backed the whole anti-terrorism effective death penalty bill that crime Bill Clinton passed. This was a precursor to the Patriot Act. These guys are just handing off the batons from one administration and from one generation to another, because they do have a program. They do have an interest that they serve. So to be under any kind of illusion that this is something other than it is basically to zigzag yourself into a state of ridiculous confusion. But next, let's hear Juan Gonzalez, who asked Zen about the issues not dealt with in these presidential debates. So let's see how Zen deals with these questions, and then we'll take it from there. So check this out.
Well, Howard, you know, as a news junkie, I've watched every minute of all four of these debates, and it still astounds me, although I think Bob Schieffer clearly did the best job of any of the questioners, at least asking some tough questions of the candidates. All of the things that were really not dealt with, the environment, the policies of the Bush administration and Kerry's policy toward the environment, not discussed at all, energy policy. And the United States has continued search for maintaining control of the world oil supply to justify our consumption. The issue of civil liberties, attacks on civil liberties by this government, and the continued pursuit of Arab Americans on false charges, the Patriot Act. None of this was discussed. And I just am astounded at these issues that many Americans, and including, I think, Tavis Smiley said, there was one question about affirmative action in African Americans, but with the continued cultural and racial changes in American society, very little attention to the continued problems of racism and discrimination, not just with African Americans, but Latinos and Arab Americans as well. I blame more on the journalists than I do on the candidates. The candidates will only respond to questions that they're asked, and the journalists haven't chosen to ask any of these questions.
Well, you as a journalist, you know, a good position to criticize the limitations of other journalists, just as I, as a historian, tend to look carefully at the kind of history that is taught in our schools and the limitations of that history. But what you're saying, Juan, about what the candidates are not discussing, what they're not bringing up, I think relates to the fact that if both candidates want to continue the war in Iraq, as they seem to do, although Kerry, you know, gives little indications that, you know, maybe he will move away from this. This is enough reason for me for voting for Kerry. He gives little hints, you know, like, you know, we shouldn't have rushed into war, implying that maybe we should have gone more slowly into war. No. But despite these little hints that Kerry gives that maybe he is more inclined to stop this war, certainly everybody's more inclined to stop this war than Bush, both candidates, by saying they will continue and the war and win the war, are saying that we will continue to have a $400 billion military budget. We will continue to be spending huge sums of money on the war. So long as they do that, even though Kerry has a better health plan and a better education plan, so long as we are spending all that money for war, we are not going to be able to give people universal health care. We are not going to be able to take care of the other problems with the environment that you were talking about, Juan. And that is whole issue of the relationship between the war and domestic policy has been missing.
Well, if that's the case, which is somewhat accurate, what he said in the end about the $400 billion military budget, and if this type of stuff continues to go on, which all one has to do is just be honest. And one can see that in all of their various documents, their various Silk Road-like strategies and next ventures of investments for military, geopolitical, strategic influence and control, which is what you do when you are a capitalist/imperialist society, then they have no choice but to maintain their military infrastructure and empire. That's just a fact. So then it goes basically without saying that what Zinn said holds true, that this is going to affect and infect any form of universal health coverage or, you know, a decent schooling system and on and on and on. Yet Zinn says that well, Kerry gives at times little hints of wanting to move away from the war, apprehensions about it, you know, that maybe at best the U.S. empire shouldn't have rushed into war. That does that mean they should have been a little bit slower, as Zen say? Well, in other words, that is all basically Kerry and his little Democratic National little committee have talked about, that they should have done better coalition building to go in before going into these imperialist endeavors, so not to be so isolated. That's the only difference. They're still talking war. They're still flying the war banner. They're still talking about the death of, or perpetuating the erosion and destruction of the environment. Because you don't hear and won't hear Kerry talk about stopping the use of depleted uranium or anything like that. That's all part of the imperial infrastructure. And it has wreaked havoc on the Iraqi people. We're now up to 40% of the population is coming down with some form of ill health effect related to depleted uranium. So there goes the environment. For Zen to this kind of crumble down into this, well, he's willing to give his vote for Kerry because Kerry has hinted at. That's all Kerry needs to do is do a little sleight of hand, and you know, for these broken down liberals and progressives that you know, we shouldn't have rushed in the way we did. I'm concerned about that. I plan on adding 40,000 more troops because we must get the job done. And I will hunt down every terrorist and kill every terrorist, including Osama bin Laden. That is nothing but imperial aggression. Because as we all know, who are not droned out and hypnotized by these Orwellian slogans, these war on drugs, I mean, drugs. These war on terrorism is not really a war on terrorism. You know, it's just Orwellian speak to justify the war on indigenous people wherever they reside that may have a beneficial advantage for the U.S. empire's endeavors and stuff. Any more than the war on drugs, which was a legitimate war on drugs. It was basically a war on black. Any more than the whole facade of the war on guns. It's truly a war on guns. It's just all a facade. As I said before, here we have a situation where liberals are embracing Kerry on some of these domestic things, like a war on guns, and saying that that symbolizes that he is more moderate and more reasonable than Boy George, because he's willing to put restrictions and prohibitions on these guns, especially assault, quote unquote, weapons. Look, damn it. Once again, these prohibitions are just Orwellian doublespeak. These gun control laws. These laws don't stop anything and are not designed to stop anything. It's easier to get drugs than it is guns, even though there's more stringent drug control laws than there are guns. So what makes anyone think that if they pass, if that's your hocus pocus belief and delusional hope, what makes anyone think that more gun control laws would stop guns and transferring of guns into the streets any more than it has drugs? What it does allow is them to then up the ante and say, well, these products are still on the street. Now we need, which is their favorite word, a war. And as all these other wars have played out, which are not what they are said to be, you know, and meant to be, a war on terrorism is basically a war on much of the third world, a war on illegal immigration, war on Latin world, war on drugs, war on black, war on crime, war on black, war on poverty, war on black, war on guns, Amadou Diallo. Amadou Diallo gets shot down by these war on guns cops out of New York, created by Giuliani under the whole pretext of getting guns off the streets, making it safer. You got these cops then form their own Guatemalan death squad. We own the night, you know. That's their code name, which basically means, nigga, if we see you on the streets at night, we're going to kill you. And that's what ends up happening. And Amadou's keys or wallet, was it a key or wallet? Doesn't matter. He becomes a collateral, becomes collateral damage in their war on guns efforts. And the average liberal progressive doesn't blink an eye that these roided out cops, you know, all jacked up on steroids and other drugs, just like these G.I. Joes are jacked up on amphetamines and stuff when they're dropping bombs on Iraqis, end up gunning down some innocent black person, all in all under the pretext of a war on guns. Geronimo G. Jaja Pratt, former Black Panther member, to bring this home on how these things are just Orwellian speak. When Geronimo got out after spending 27 years in prison, an interesting thing came out. And one of the things that came out was that Julius Butler, who was the FBI police informant that helped incarcerate him, he was the informant for the FBI and police. Julius Butler had a long felony record. And under California law, if you had the type of felony record that he had, you could not own or buy a handgun. It came out during the appeals hearing that not only was Julius Butler allowed to purchase a gun by the police and the FBI, but they gave him the money to buy one. Which goes to just the hardcore reality. Once again, these gun control laws are not about, quote-unquote, keeping guns out of terrorist hands or criminals' hands. It's whose side are you on? If you're on the side of the state, you can have all the guns you want. Because all they're going to do is use those laws as a pretext of targeting their undesirable populations. Under the black codes, during the Reconstruction period, or the destruction of the Reconstruction period, when these laws were passed, destroying the Reconstruction period, there were various black codes passed, which had all of these gun control laws. It didn't disarm the black, but it used, it allowed the state, under the pretext of fighting a war against guns, to crush the black communities into the ground. The Klan was allowed to have all the guns they wanted. Same with in Nazi Germany. Under the pretext, under the Nazis in the 1934 gun laws and, you know, registration acts and all of that type of stuff, they used it as a pretext to attack the undesirables, you know, communists, gypsies, Jews, so on and so forth. The brown shirts could have all the guns they wanted because they were on the side of the state. So gun control laws, just like many of these other laws, are fascistic laws designed to justify the attack under the banner of a war against the undesirable people within its borders, and in the case of a war on terrorism, outside of its borders. That's the real world. Now next, Amy asks in about the letter he and other liberals signed saying vote for Kerry. So let's see how Zen deals with this, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
There are some anti-war candidates, people like David Cobb, Green Party, Ralph Nader. Now, there was that controversial letter that you signed along with Noam Chomsky and others calling for people to vote for Kerry in the swing states. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I didn't think I'd find a controversial letter in me. I try not to be controversial, but I guess there are people, very strong supporters of Nader and Cobb, who are annoyed because a number of us said, people who admire Nader, admire the Green Party, said people should vote for Kerry in the swing states. And I think the reason is this, and I don't know if I...
speaking for all the other signers of the petition, but probably I would guess that this is their thinking. Certainly it's my thinking, and that is, you know, that admire Nader enormously. I mean, Nader stands, you know, miles high above these other candidates in terms of his morality, in terms of his contribution to the country. But this election is the wrong place for him to put his great energy and talent. And it's a waste of his stature to put his all of his work that he has done into counting the votes in an election which he can't win anyway. And the Bush administration is so dangerous, and this is, I think, our feeling. This is the most dangerous administration we have had. It is so authoritarian, so fundamentalist. Juan mentioned the Patriot Act. Unswerving in this determination, apparently, to rule the world and to go into war after war. And it is so dangerous an administration, so tied to the rich, although sure, both parties are tied to the rich, one party tied a little more closely. But the Bush administration is so dangerous that I think it is very important to get these people out of office. And with Kerry in office, our thought is we will have a tiny ledge to stand on, from which then to move on.
I interviewed Ralph Nader, and he was, to say the least, very disturbed about this letter, and said at least the letter could have included a demand, that it wasn't just giving the support over unconditionally. And it's interesting, looking at your latest book that you did with Anthony Arnoff, Voices of a People's History of the United States, you begin with that famous quote of Frederick Douglass, that there's no struggle, there's no progress, this struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will.
Well, Frederick Douglass is right, and Ralph Nader is right, and probably the letter could have been stronger, I agree, in making demands. I think we need to make demands, even if we are saying vote for Kerry in the swing state. We need to make demands of Kerry, and the important thing, and this I say on the basis of the history of presidential elections and the history of taking care of deep grievances in American society. The history shows that the really important thing is not who sits in the White House, but who sits outside the White House. The really important thing, you know, is not who is elected, even though it's sure it's a little better to have one candidate rather than another. The really important thing is what our citizens are doing to create a huge movement in the country which will act upon, put pressure upon, make demands upon whatever candidate wins. That's the really important thing. So that, you know, I would support Kerry for 1 minute in the election booth before and after. I would try to join a movement of citizens that will demand that we get out of Iraq and demand that we use our immense resources to help people all over the world.
Well, as Amy quoted, you're not making any demands of him. Basically, you're doing just what you basically said. That you yourself then said that for Kerry to be in an office, you feel that you have a tiny ledge to stand on. Basically, that ledge is like a plank, you know, at the end of the boat. And outside of the plank is the water with that shark infested, with Democrats and Republicans waiting to eat you up. But you still walk out on that tiny ledge, that tiny plank, thinking that jumping off the plank, you're going to get some kind of solace and stuff, instead of taking over the boat. I mean, this whole thing about here, a historian is demoralized when he quotes Frederick Douglass about power concedes nothing and so on and so forth, yet himself admits that if, you know, power concedes nothing, you know, without, you know, power, and without, you know, any form of demand action. And he admits they don't make any demands. They just roll over for him. So here's the historian quoting passages of legendary figures, but doesn't even know how to apply it to his own life because he's just beat down. I mean, what could be more pathetic than that? I mean, look, I said this before. We have a situation where, you know, these guys with this whole this is what happens when you get into this whole lesser of two evil, anyone but Bush claptrap. Every 4 years, they have more than enough time in between to write out, you know, it could be 50, 100 questions to all the Democratic candidates and hand it to them. And if they answer, you know, in a negative more than 25-30% of the time, they can't be considered a lesser evil candidate. It could be questions like, you know, do you support the School of the Americas? Do you support the School of the State of Israel? Do you support structural adjustment, IMF, World Bank policies? Do you support WTO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? They have all the time in the world to do this beforehand. Yet, they never do it because in part they know that there's no level that the raggedy Democrats won't sink to. So instead, they wait to the last second and then rush out with these hitting the panic button, all claiming that the current Republican in office or Republican who's about to try to get into office is, you know, the next thing, next to Hitler and stuff like that. And once again, it's all taken out of historical context, even by historians, et cetera, et cetera. I've asked readers, you know, when they throw out these, you know, next move towards fascism type of politician quotes that they throw out there, to read, you know, various books or one of some of these books like Fascism in Big Business or Saving Private Power or IBM and the Holocaust or Henry Ford and the Jews. And what you'll find in these various books is that when the various ruling circles before they went to war against Germany were watching Adolf, they were supporting him in his rise so that he could overtake and crush many of the political organizations that were competing for a position of power in Germany at the time, in those early stages. And they didn't want the communists to win or the social democrats, you know, which is kind of like what neighbor is, you know, kind of reformist or anything like that. So they just decided to go and put their backings behind this straight up fascist. And when the ruling class was backing this fascist, Henry Ford, IBM, Standard Oil, all the way down the line, both the Democrat and Republican Party were goose-stepping right behind them. In other words, their independent political integrity, morality, or positions were not predicated on their own individual outlook. They were looking through the eyes of their particular ruling class within this society. And when big business was steadfastly behind Adolf, so were they, the Democrats and the Republicans. That's the real world. So to hear these guys be ahistorical, you know, including historians, this is some sad stuff. This gives an indication of about how Boy George's administration is the most dangerous we've ever had and stuff, without putting it into a context that the world is growing more and more dangerous within the whole political, social, historical landscape that we're in right now, that there are no vibrant competing bodies that can somewhat hold the U.S. in check or make them waver a little bit, has emboldened the U.S. Now, without a doubt, the most progressive things that are happening in the world today are in Latin America, you know, from various things that are going on in, you know, Argentina, Brazil, some of the things that are going on in Venezuela, Cuba, et cetera, et cetera. Much of the freedom struggles and vibing for and looking for alternative solutions as opposed to, you know, the state-based systems, those have basically been dissolved and demoralized and or crushed. Many of their various populations of those advocates, from the whole spectrum of them, have been thoroughly liquidated. You've had seen, you know, the rollbacks in Africa, in the Middle East, and its anti-colonialist struggles as they've been neo-colonialized in many ways throughout many regions. The backwardness of the Soviet Union exposed and highlighted as it cowers down into, you know, this kind of a frantic state. The you know, same thing with China and on and on and on. So this has helped, what I'm saying is this has helped embolden the U.S. empire along with some of its own crises that it finds itself in. This has led it to become even more vehement on using this military prowess and shock troop power. So it's not so much of a particular administration. It has to do with the world affairs that the U.S. empire finds itself, that we basically have topped out on the maximum findable petroleum in the world. And from here on, we're going to start steadily on the decline, and how that plays into world affairs and things like that for imperialist empires that are not really interested in developing alternative energy systems based off of living energy systems, you know, wind power, solar power. They want to see how they can further control other regions through the scarcity of resources for their own economic and political control. So it's all a grand chessboard game for them. At the ecologies and at human expense. This is how imperialists play this game. It has nothing to do really with some raggedy Democrat or Republican being in office. More people in Iraq died during crime Bill Clinton's administration than during this president barbarian's administration, Boy George's. You know, up to 1 million people died during crime Bill Clinton's administration. Was that somehow a softer form of imperialism, a more likable one for people like Zinn, because the bullets weren't flying? You know, visibly flying. You know, they just basically were starving them off on their little reservation and doing the little no-fly zones here and there every once in a while that were hardly covered. You know, I mean, this shows you how sick and depleted many of the things have gotten in this society. When you hear people who are supposed to be, you know, quote-unquote progressive, buffoon out themselves, gumpify themselves down into these types of argument. But, you know, here, I show you how all these things are interconnected. Here's a Howard Dean. You know, he's the former Democratic presidential candidate. You know, he has a book out now, You Have the Power. You know, he was recently on the Terry Gross Show, and he describes how he was sabotaged by his own party. So let's see what Dean has to say, and we'll take it from there. So check this out.
Howard Dean served as governor of Vermont from 1991 to 2003. He's now honorary chairman of Democracy for America, an organization dedicated to building a grassroots network for the Democratic Party. You write that when you were running in the primary, that the Democrats said that you were dangerously far from the mainstream, and your Democratic rivals had created a secret pact to go after you in Iowa, and they were spending $1 million running negative attack ads against you. You say this is the kind of tactic that Democrats and Republicans routinely use on each other, but I'd never seen Democrats doing it to one another, and I was furious. And then you say it made you wonder, why should you still be a Democrat after all this? So why are you?
Well, I think that in the long run, it has to be about the country, not about me. And as Al Gore told me in the part of the book that follows up on that story, this really is about the country. And there was no way that a third-party person could possibly win this election. All a third-party person was going to do on the Democratic Party side was to take votes away from John Kerry. George Bush is a national disaster, in my view. He's the least competent president we've had since Warren Harding. And he's an activist incompetent president, which makes him more dangerous. So I really wanted to do everything I could to make sure that John Kerry won. And, you know, as I got to know John Kerry after the primaries were over, I came to respect him. I think he's a bright, thoughtful person who understands the issues. He's inquisitive, and he marshals the evidence before he acts, and that's really important in a president.
All right, now, once again, here you get many indications of how decrepit the Democratic Party is, even though Howard doesn't want to truly just say it as it really is, because he's basically beat down and disciplined himself. You know, when the Democratic Party and various other elements, too, I would say the corporate media, basically did their secret pact to crush him and just characterize him as, you know, some angry, aloof, you know, nutcase, that was a disciplining measure. You know, because he was fairly outspoken for a Democrat against the war. And he needed to be disciplined for having that kind of agenda. And all of the Democrats agreed, as he himself said, to put the screws to him. Because he was going outside of the box that was acceptable for the ruling class. So, but he rationalizes it. And to still stay in a Democrat by saying that, it's not about the him, it's about the country. Now, you know, Al Gore could basically, you could take what Al Gore did during the 2000 election, that whole thing, it's not about me being the president, it's about the country. But what they mean is that it's maintaining the false integrity of the system. With Howard, you basically heard how basically the Democrats exposed themselves and how wretched they are and how basically they are part of the imperial mechanism. With Gore, Paulus broke the story before Gore had conceded that Jeb Bush, Catherine Harris, basically electronically Jim Crowed 90,000 plus mainly black people from the voting roll. And Gore and the Senate refused to do any kind of investigation and refused to expose this before Gore had conceded. In other words, they were more concerned. Now, they'll phrase it as maintaining the country in the best interest of the country. But what they really mean is maintain the illusion of the system being a system and a society that is somehow humane and is not a savage, barbaric, wicked, undemocratic system that it really is. So they are more concerned about maintaining the country's illusion. That's what they mean when they talk about, it's not about me, it's about the country. They're talking about the system, the ruling class that they serve. The last thing is, you know, when Dean talks about, how Boy George is the least competent president, since Warren Harding, and all that. You know, look, when people make fun of Boy George's idiocy, that's more a reflection, though, in reality of the poor state of where the working class is in America and where the left is. The fact of the matter is, nationally and internationally. It's true that back in the 60s, you know, during JFK's time, they couldn't have afforded to have in a gump like Boy George, because there was too many issues that needed to be addressed on a serious, at least somewhat more intellectual area. You had Africa decolonializing, the Arab world struggling. You had Cuba to deal with, you know, Che and them all throughout Latin America. You had China and the Soviet Union and so on and so forth. So you needed someone who could be a little bit more intellectual on his feet. But you know, much of that stuff has dispersed. So they don't need the same types of characters to be in those positions that they once did. Basically, a boy George is good enough. Now, let's go back to Zen and see more Zen-zagging here. And this is an excerpt from a speech in New York that Zen gave concerning the elections. Now, we heard some of the stuff that Zen has said before, you know, when he was talking to Amy and them. Now, let's see what he has to say in this particular speech and connect some of the dots. Zigzagging dots, that is. Check this out.
In a certain sense, you can't lose in baseball. No matter who you're rooting for, because it'll always be exciting. In a presidential election, you'll always lose. And you have to understand that from the beginning. You have to understand that whatever you do, you know, the moment you spend in the voting booth, you don't have to tell anybody about, you know, you get rid of it. And the important thing is what you have done before that moment in the voting booth and what you'll do after that moment in the voting booth. You see? So,
masculinity.
I'm supposed to talk about war and the elections. I'll try my best. Yeah. Although it's hard to avoid them, right? Let me say something about the election first. Maybe I'll come back to it, and maybe I won't, depending on how I feel. But first thing to notice is this election is such a commentary on our political system. Imagine, here's a political system in which half the country has already indicated that it is opposed to the war. 50% of the country opposed to the war and 100% of the candidates in favor of the war. Now, that is not a free election. It's interesting this is not a democratic election. I mean, it's really funny. Here we are organizing democratic elections in Afghanistan, organizing free elections in Iraq. We're always organizing free elections everywhere in the world except here. You see, where we really need it, you see. And I think we have to think about those issues that are not brought up in an election campaign like this. You know. And because what we want to do, I think, is to move the country, you know, beyond those limited boundaries set by the two major parties. And for instance, right, so we know what that limited boundary is right now in relation to the war in Iraq. We know that Bush wants to pursue the war in Iraq until victory. Kerry wants to pursue the war in Iraq until victory, but with help. The idea being that if this is the wrong war in the wrong place and the wrong time, let's bring more countries into it so that they can participate in the wrong war.
So here's Zen rightly talking about that the only difference basically concerning the war, which has the main attention of many people, Boy George wants to pursue the war till victory, and Kerry wants to do it with help. You know, basically, which is, have more collaborators, and that proves that you are being more diplomatic and fits in with liberals' soft imperial agenda. You know, because it doesn't look like you're being a lone ranger, go it alone type of thing. It's still imperialism. It's still causing death and mayhem amongst the masses of people. It's still structurally adjusting them down into their own deaths, premature deaths. It's still a killing machine. So here is Zen honestly talking about this at this little speech he gave. Yet, you know, he's saying not there, but, you know, in the interview, and is the one who wrote the little or was involved in signing this whole thing, a letter about voting for Kerry and not wanting Nader to run and stuff. Now, if that's not the height of hypocrisy and being broken down, especially when you tie it to the fact that he himself said that various domestic issues, health care and other things, are tied within to the whole military budget and stuff. So if Kerry still wants to be a military imperialist dragon, which of course he is, because he's tied to the imperial machine as an administrator, just on the Democratic side, then of course there is no fundamental difference, you know. So and he starts it off basically admitting that in his speech, saying that no matter who you vote for, you lose. Well, if that's the case, then why participate? You know, why participate in your own illusion? That's as you know, this is just like an article of faith, that you're going to maintain faith in a corroded, inhumane, savage, discredited system, even though you know in your heart of hearts, that it does not serve the interests and cannot serve the interests of the masses. But you're still going to go through the process. That's just basically being broken and beat down. And it is passing down and passing on that legacy of defeatism. Why participate in something that you know is discredited, that you know is rigged? Now, it's true that what really counts is what you do, what is done regardless of who's president. Now, he likes to frame it before you pull the lever and after you pull the lever. But the reality is whoever is put in that Wizard of Oz, put behind that Wizard of Oz curtain, whoever is pulling those levers behind there, as a Democrat or a Republican, what does count is how you organize and struggle against this barbaric system, and what kind of destiny you are going to try to set afoot for yourself and like-minded people. But if you're as broken as he is, you're going to go back and forth from 1 minute saying, well, Kerry at time gives little hints of apprehension about the war, you know, that maybe they shouldn't have rushed too fast. And that's why you're going to vote for him and put out a letter to someone else who's, you know, I mean, he's still within the system. I mean, Nader and all of that. But you don't even want him to run. You know, you feel that Nader running is a waste of time, but don't question yourself honestly about you voting for a Democrat or Republican being a waste of time, or anyone else who supports the system, Nader or whoever. You know, I mean, that's just the height of being and having one's soul crushed. But last, to show how this Zen zagging bourgeois capitalist stuff can lead you into a divided state of consciousness, here thrown in the mix is another person who was on Terry Gross's show, Pat Buchanan, who has his own version of a lesser of evil concept. And Pat Buchanan's concept of a lesser of evil is just as valid as the average raggedy liberal. Here's what I mean. Check this out.
So I think the president is being supported because he is president, because Republicans are loyal to their leader and to their president, because this is a close election, and because George Bush is infinitely preferable to John Kerry. But I would not take that for full assent to all of the Bush policies. across the Republican spectrum, there is an enormous amount of grumbling and dissent about where the president has been leading the country.
Now, do you think that some of the people who share your opinion don't want to say so publicly because it would sound divisive?
Of course, that's correct. I think the president's going to get the support, probably, I've seen some polls, of 97% of conservatives and Republicans, because of the apprehension that if he does not get those votes, then the presidency will go to John Kerry, whom they believe, correctly, is a Massachusetts liberal with almost a 100% liberal voting record, and whose performance when he came back from Vietnam they truly abhor. So they're standing behind the president now, and frankly, inside the Democratic Party. There are many Dean supporters who are backing John Kerry, who probably are grinding their teeth as he says that he will win this war. So I think inside both parties, the coalitions who are standing behind their man in this election do not necessarily agree with their man in this election.
Do you consider yourself a Republican now? I mean, you ran on the reform ticket.
Well, I would consider myself an independent conservative who clearly is leaning to President Bush for the reason that I think the president has been very good on the issues of taxes, on conservative judges, on values, and on the defense of America's sovereignty with his opposition to the Kyoto Protocol and the International Criminal Court. But where the president agrees with Kerry, which is on trade, on immigration policy, on Iraq, and on other policies, I disagree with the president.
That just about says it all. Here you have a situation where Pat Buchanan is talking about how the Republicans, even though many of them have many problems with Boy, they are remaining loyal to their leader. And this is how many of these liberal and progressive types, Kerry has become their kind of anointed leader. Not because, quote-unquote, he's earned it. Not because their politics align anywhere close to his, or at least what they claim are theirs. It's basically because they came to the mountaintop and a burning bush had an image of Kerry burning on it. So they disobediently followed it. The Buchanan talks about how there is grumbling amongst Republicans about Bush and where he's leading the country. Well, there's grumblings about where many liberals and progressives think that Kerry would lead the country through the things that he's advocating. But just like the Republican drones, these liberal drones obediently follow their leader, too. They often talk, the liberals and progressives talk about not sounding too divisive, just like the Republicans. You know, they talk about, the Republicans say the difference is, in part, is that, you know, Kerry has 100% liberal voting record. But as I talked about, you know, gun control and things like that, these aren't really liberal or conservative per se. They're basically part of an apparatus of state control within the system. That's how these guys play these particular games out. So this is all a joke. Then Buchanan talks about how many Dean supporters are probably grinding their teeth, and because Kerry keeps talking about how he's going to win this imperialist war. In other words, once again, I don't need to go back into the Dean thing, but basically, Kerry was the anointed one, and these guys obediently follow them regardless. And then they use any kind of justification whatsoever to get people to drone themselves down to back them. This is just a beat down population. And then Buchanan, who, because he's one of these types of, he's kind of a seclusionist imperialist, So he was against this particular Iraqi war, not because he's against imperialism per se, but he has his own kind of isolationism that he keeps close to his chest on when the U.S. should and should not imperialize someone else's landscape. But Buchanan himself says that Kerry and Boy George are the same on trade, immigration, and the Iraqi war. You know, they are basically virtually the same. So in essence, my whole point in throwing this out is that the arguments that Buchanan uses for remaining a loyal Republican supporter is not that different than Dean. That, unfortunately, is not that different from Howard Zinn, who is, you would hope would be somewhat outside of that little box. But if you get yourself caught up in this lesser of two evil, anyone but Bush, you know, at least I can stand on a little plank, you know, with Kerry in office, you know, on a little ledge without looking at the fact that the ledge is over a 3,000-foot cliff, you know, and that Kerry and other Democrats are sawing off the ledge you're standing on while you speak, then basically you're doomed. Doomed in your own confusion and demoralization. Think outside of the box, for your own existence is at stake. Hold on a sec. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up this late tonight. It's clear that whether you are a Norm Solomon type or a Chomsky or a historian like Howard Zinn, if you don't use some of the own things that are supposed to be part of your foundation, like in Zinn's case, historian, you are going to be caught on the other side of the game and the other side of the ledge. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.